Welcome to Insight Aviation, helping you to take a look inside the world of captains, aerospace professionals, air traffic controllers, and much more. Learn how they got started, where they are now, and their advice for aspiring aviators. This series is brought to you by Wayman Aviation Academy. Learn to fly with a safe, reliable, professional academy, located between Miami and Fort Lauderdale in sunny South Florida, USA. Enjoy the training and cosmopolitan life with Wayman's 42 aircraft, 6 airline partners, and 2 bases to help you be the captain. Welcome, everyone, to the Insight Aviation podcast. We're coming here to you with Carlos Rivera. And before we jump into things, let's start with a little word from our sponsor.
Be the captain.
Be the captain.
Be the captain.
Welcome to Wayman Aviation Academy.
The thing that sets Wayman apart from other flight schools here, basically the location, fleet size,
being able to provide high quality training.
They have the resources, they have the fleet, they had everything I was looking for to start my career as a pilot.
Wayman is a very airline-oriented operation.
The Academy offers complete ab initio flight training programs and courses.
Get to know each student, because each student is different.
Wayman Aviation Academy operates a large fleet of more than 40 airplanes and full-motion flight simulators.
Here, maintenance is priority number one, and we take pride in what we do.
Realizing your dreams at Wayman is within reach.
I choose Wayman.
I choose Wayman.
I choose Wayman.
Wayman Aviation Academy, developing the skills and attitudes for safe, successful, and professional pilots around the world. Changing lives through aviation.
Hello, and welcome to the Insight Aviation Podcast, where we bring you professionals from throughout the aviation industry, captains, air traffic controllers, airport managers, and so much more. And today we have one of those so much mores, a friend, a colleague, someone I've had the opportunity to know and work with now for probably like the better part of the last decade, Carlos Rivera. Please introduce yourself.
Hey, everyone. Thank you, Eddie. Thank you for having me. I'm Carlos Rivera, former air traffic controller in Cuba. Worked with Wayman Aviation as a dispatch manager for quite a bit, had a great time there. Then move on to IBC Airways as a OCC manager, and now I'm with National Airlines as a duty manager at their SOC, or Systems Operations Control.
So there's a lot to unpack there, you know, from your time in air traffic control, what aviation's like in Cuba, the time you spent with us, IBC, which flies around the Caribbean, and of course, your current position, National. But let's start right there, because this is one of those unique positions that a lot of people don't kind of fully understand or what it does. So maybe you can just explain to us, what is a duty manager? What does a duty manager do?
Right. Well, because of the complexity of a big Part 121 airline there, Systems Operation Control, you need a duty manager. You need a person that's there all the time, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, besides all the individual department managers that work together inside the SLC. So what a duty manager does is he manages the operation during his shift. He manages the personnel. He manages all the departments during that time frame to make sure scheduled disruptions are minimized and keep everything running smoothly from dispatch to ground operations, crew scheduling, mission planning, and maintenance control. You need a background as a dispatcher to be able to operate, because that's the most restrictive position inside the SOC. You do need a certificate. And in case something should happen, you have to be ready to take over and assist as a dispatcher. So that's basically, in a nutshell, my job.
So it sounds like you're the front line, kind of running the show, like whatever, you're kind of the problem solver. Whatever comes your way, you've got to be like, okay, we need to do X, Y, Z for the mission to be successful.
Yes, you got it. That's basically what you do. You're the conductor of the orchestra. You have all these different departments working on, you have to make sure they come together to bring the operation forward.
That's really interesting. So, so you recently shared with me this excellent video of National Airlines flying a humanitarian mission to Kathmandu,
yes.
Right? And it's really interesting. Sam Chui, which everyone knows in the internet space, helped National make that. And I know they coordinated with you. And when you're watching it, they run into a lot of problems, right? Like, I think they get rerouted when they're in over Afghanistan or something like that. And so are they, they're talking to you.
Yes.
Figure things out.
They were in Pakistan, and the all of a sudden, the I believe it was, it was Pakistan. So the routing change, that information, the pilot has to send it back to dispatch. Dispatch has to rerun the numbers, resend the flight plan, make sure that the fuel that we have set up for that flight meets the FAA requirements for international flights and we have all the fuel reserves and everything is fine before we can send a new flight plan to the crew and re-release the aircraft.
So talk about support crew, right? This is when we always talk about how when there's, for every captain in the cockpit, there's 50 people in support. Like, I think dispatch is right there, right? Right over the shoulder, making sure the airplane has the fuel it needs. It's not going to fly into any airspace it'll have trouble with, probably weather, all those things, right? Weight and balances. And these things are constantly fluctuating when you're flying, when you reach destinations. Not just the weather, but like everything that goes around it, right? You've burned fuel getting from A to B, and how does that change your next stop? It's quite a bit going on.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's part of the reasons why the FAA has the shared responsibility, pilot and dispatchers, 50% operational control. They share, if one does not agree with what the other one is presenting or bringing to the table, they have to work it out until everybody is in concurrence of what they want to do, then the flight can be dispatched. And there's many variables. And if you look inside, operation control centers or SOCs, however the airline decides to call it, there are numerous TVs with the news channels all over the world. Mm-hmm. For instance, not too long ago, we were flying over from Dubai. We're taking off from Dubai, I can't remember the destination, but we were flying over Myanmar and there was some political unrest and they closed down the airspace. Wow. So by watching the news, we were able to identify right away. And before we even got to the airspace border, we had a plan B in place. Mission planning had applied for emergency permit somewhere else, and we were able to redirect the aircraft around the airspace. And you can see everybody else holding at the airspace border trying to figure out what to do. So it's a very proactive process. You have to stay on top of things.
You know, that's really interesting because and aviation is international by nature, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, your airplanes are probably up in the air right now flying on the opposite side of the world. And so when you're working with somebody that's, in this case, you know, Pakistan, Nepal, they're a good, 10, 11 hours time zone difference.
Oh, yeah.
So someone is up here, you're based out of Orlando, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
So somebody's up in Orlando at 3 a.m, keep an eye on that 747, and then boom, here comes this problem. Like, all right, let's figure it out.
Yep.
All right.
It's 24/7, and sometimes people think, oh, you got the night shift, you guys are working the night today, it's going to be quiet. No, it's 10 a.m. somewhere else in the world, and we have 3 airplanes on that side. So
yeah,
you always have to stay on top of things. It's busy 24 hours a day.
That's interesting. And I like what you're saying there about making sense of what's going on in the world, just keeping track of the news. So we're an international flight school, and so we're always tracking as well what's going on in the world, right? Like we were getting a good amount of students from Southeast Asia, and then, you know, we're keeping track of countries opening, countries closing, and I'm sure now you have the whole new layer of COVID requirements, right? Do they have this? When was their last test? When was their last PCR or whatever? Because that changes country to country as well.
Oh yeah, and we have that for crews. It's very, we don't have a base. We operate worldwide. Mm-hmm. So we have to position our crews to take the flight wherever they're going. So it is a challenge. You have to make sure they meet all the COVID requirements at each different country that we fly to, and it's endless. It's an ad hoc operation, a full 100% busy everyday ad hoc, and you gotta stay on top of things. And when COVID was on top of at its peak in the world, it was a logistical challenge flying those crew members around. It got to a point where we had to take our own 757, passenger 757, put our crews on board, the crews that we were going to need during that week, and position them in the world everywhere. Fly the 75 back. Yeah, we have to do our own because there were no airlines flying.
It's true.
Everybody was shut down. No passenger, no way to get those people around. So we had to do it ourselves.
That's amazing. And
yeah.
Your 757 became a very specialized charter, passenger charter for that time.
Charter.
Wow, that's interesting. So let's take a moment there because you hit on a very important note there about the dispatcher role, right? And that's something that a lot of people don't realize. Like I became aware of a few years ago that a dispatcher has to do the exact same ATP, airline transport pilot test.
Yes.
Well, pretty close to the same test that an airline pilot would do, right? And that's like the biggest, hardest test in aviation, right? And it's the starting point for dispatchers, right? So tell us about that. You spent some time in the dispatcher role. Different organizations. What's that like to have to tackle that big test and do?
Well, it's just, you know, every pilot will tell you doing ATP is one of the hardest things. It's the end of their well, not the end, it's actually the beginning of their career as a airline transfer pilot, but it's the end of your study. That's the last thing you have to do before you get on a big plane. And dispatchers have to jump right into that. And what I used to study was an ATP book that I got at Wayman Pilot Shop. That was my study guide. So dispatchers, we studied based on the ATP book. And it was, I did ATC. I've done quite a few things. And those 5 weeks that I spent studying for dispatch have been the hardest because it's a lot of information to do in 5 weeks.
It is.
But a lot of very useful, if you're an app geek like myself, you absolutely enjoy every bit of information you get from dispatch training.
So the airline transport test, which makes sense for a dispatcher, right? Because you are a captain on the ground.
Yeah.
Right, you're in communications, you're doing all the calculations and routings and things like that. You're the, like you said, the other 50% of operational control. So the ATP test, of course, you got to understand aerodynamics, meteorology, probably at a very high level.
Yes.
Weight and balance, my gosh, that's probably a big part of the job. Right. And I can't imagine all these different categories. And to know it at an airline level, you know, pilots, you kind of imagine yourself in the chair, right? And so you're like, okay, well, if I was making a left-hand climbing turn, the airplane would do this, right? But I imagine that people who don't have that pilot background, you can't, it's hard to place yourself in that imagination. Like, well, the airplane would do this if I was, you know, making a left turn or a right turn. You just have to know it, right? To study. It's a very specific thing. I know that there's a great school that does it here in Fort Lauderdale. Our partner, Miami-Dade College, I think is reinitiating their dispatcher program. And you find them around the country, but it's a very small niche. Who gets into dispatching? I mean, I think people don't really kind of wake up and say, I want to be a dispatcher. They kind of discover it.
Right. Actually, myself, I discovered it. Just doing some research, what do I want to do? What's the best way to get back to my aviation career? I obviously couldn't do ATC when I got here because of the age limitation going in and so on. So I was looking for something else, an alternative, and something that was really hands-on. And I discovered dispatch. And, if you can't hold a medical certificate as a pilot, if you fly and it's not really for you, if you feel, I get a lot of motion sickness, I don't really want to be in the plane 24 hours a day or traveling around the world, for the entire month and going home for a few weeks at a time. Dispatching is a excellent way to get into it because you're really, really hands-on the operation on the aircraft. Sometimes you tell pilot things that he doesn't even know himself because obviously he's concentrated on his side of the operation and you have the bigger picture. You have everything that's going on everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very interesting. And, if somebody wants to do, wants to be really into aviation, really into the flight operation side of things, and it can't be a pilot or does not want to be a pilot, this is definitely one of the good options we have out there.
You're kind of like the third crew member, the second officer.
Yes.
Now, that's a good point. So I imagine there's probably a good amount of retired captains or disabled captains with medicals lost that are doing this role.
Yeah, absolutely. We on the dispatch side, we have actually a few pilots, young pilots and retired pilots working for National. And we have one of the younger guys, it's one of those excellent guy. He's one of those certificate collectors out there. He's an air traffic controller. He is a pilot and also a dispatcher.
Yeah.
And I tell him, man, what's up next? He said, I want to get my AMP license too.
I bet if you look at his wallet, he also has a scuba certification. And yeah. I've known quite a few certificate collectors. There's quite a bit of them in aviation, right? So let's take a step back and then we'll kind of come back to this. How did you, Carlos Rivera, get interested in aviation?
Oh, well, aviation's been in my family and it continues to be for the longest time, as long as I can remember, being on an airplane. My father worked for Cubana Airlines back home several years ago. And I had the great privilege and opportunity to travel the world. He was first the general manager of Cubana Airlines in Jamaica. Then we moved over to Canada. So I was on an airplane every week flying one of those old Soviet era aircraft, but it just stuck on me. And this is what I want to do. I actually began studying mechanical engineering in college. And at some point I saw the opportunity for aircraft control that came up and I said, this is what I want to do. Mechanical engineering is fine, but this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. So I'm going to jump into it. And I've been doing it ever since.
So, I mean, it's a very different system, right? Coming up in Cuba and kind of going through the educational system and the job placement system. But, I mean, I don't even know. What would be the biggest differences, you think, between like somebody like yourself coming up in Cuba? Because there's lots of people from around the world, you know, who might be listening to this podcast, and they're not in the U.S. And the systems vary widely. It's hard to imagine yourself accessing air traffic control or being a pilot or even a dispatcher when you're in countries like our students coming from Indonesia or Peru or Cuba or our friends in Venezuela. Like, tell us, it had to be difficult to pursue that.
Yeah, well, that's a good point, Eddie. Coming back here, air traffic control is international. It's governed by ICAO, so the separation minimums are standard everywhere in the world. It can only be more strict, right? So on that side of things, it's pretty much the same. There's no changes. The biggest changes for me, what I saw, I mean, I haven't done air traffic control here, but I've been lucky enough to, fortunate enough to be in air traffic control tower and, you know, take our women students up to see how air traffic control works, right? So the biggest difference is automation and technology utilization. Back home in Cuba, there was technology. We, as a matter of fact, we use a Canadian software there to for our radar system and such. But at smaller air traffic control towers or approach control train cons, there was not as much. So, for example, I'm going to tell you on one of the first towers I worked at in San Diego, we had to do the flight strips manually.
Okay.
So at the end of the day, on your you know, the last flight of your ship, you're working overnight, that air traffic controller will have to set up all the flights for the next day. Maybe you have 20, 30, or 50 flights that you have to write manually and leave ready for the next ship, right? While we were there, that changed. We found a way to automate that. So we took all the ATC strips, the message from AFTN messaging system coming in, a system that would translate that. We used Microsoft Access, I believe it was, yes. And we'll translate that into the strip, and that will print automatically on a little point printer that we had. It made it a lot easier. But for me, that was the biggest difference, you know, automation and technology that's available. The rest is pretty much the same.
You know, it's kind of funny. I'm kind of putting things together in my head as I think about this, because we're in Miami, of course, and so we've always had Cuban students and Cuban staff. But I do have to say that you, Carlos, and your Cuban colleagues that came with you that were ex-Cubana and ex-air traffic control, if I have to say there's a common thread here, it's that Cubans are problem solvers, right? You'll take whatever you have in your hand and be like, all right, I can work with this. Yeah. And just make it, you know, like the cars that keep running from 50 years ago,
right?
But you just have this ability to make the most out of what you have because of necessity, I imagine. That I can almost draw a direct line to you being like the general problem solver, duty manager, right? It was a trial by fire. So you started college as a mechanical engineer. You saw an opportunity to do air traffic control.
Right.
Now, the mechanical engineering, I guess, was from that exposure to airlines through your father?
It was, you know, just through my father, basically. You know, everybody wants their son to be an engineer, do something. Sure. And I said, oh, I like this part of thing. And, you know, designing and making all kinds of parts and mechanical components for factories. I really enjoyed doing that. But again, aviation is what caught my attention and what's in my heart. So
yeah.
As soon as I saw the opportunity, I said, you know, okay, here I go.
Yeah, that's a beautiful thing. Aviation is a passion, you know. I don't know that many people that are that passionate about pulley systems and, you know,
yes.
Factory setups. But talk about aviation and airplanes, and you know, they just keep going, right?
It's incredible. Yeah. Nowadays, it's very common. Aviation is a common thing. Everybody's used to getting on an airplane and flying, and there's thousands of aircraft everywhere, thousands of airports. But still, there's that passion. People that get bitten by that aviation bug and never come back.
So. That's true. That's true. Yeah. It bites hard.
Right.
So you become an air traffic controller and in Santiago de Cuba, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
And it's a pretty large city within Cuba. So a lot of international traffic. I had the opportunity to fly through Cuban airspace, actually coming from Cancun and talking to Havana Control. It's really interesting. And I just find it amazing that as much political turmoil and all that as there is around the island, there's the professionalism of air traffic control, right? Like, we've got a job to do. People rely on us, not just Cubans, but everybody flying from throughout the Americas, really, right? And that's true anywhere, because you have to fly over some tricky airspace. I imagine National has to fly over some tricky airspace. Just like you said, learning airspace is opening, closing. Some have are a lot more restrictive than others. Mm-hmm. So that has to be an interesting thing that's kind of carried with you. So you saw your opportunity to come to the United States, and we had an opportunity to work together at Wayman Aviation, right? So the dispatcher role at Wayman Aviation is not nearly as complicated, I'm sure, as it is at National, right? But, you know, basically we have a fleet of airplanes. When you were with us, I think it was probably somewhere between 10 and 12 airplanes, I think, at the time. Yeah. Now it's close to 40 airplanes. Wow. So that's grown, right? The facilities have grown and things like that. But really, you helped us kind of create that role. Because before then, we would have a counter person, right? And that's common in most flight schools, where you have a person at the counter that, hands out the clipboards, the keys, you know, takes care of people. But you took it to another step. I guess you brought that knowledge and the professionalism you had with you, and you created this dispatcher role, right? So if you think back about that, what were some highlights? What did you like about being a dispatcher at a flight school?
Eddie, it was an excellent. It was actually one of the best things that happened to me here in the States. Working with Wayman, it opened the doors to the aviation world to me. And that brings me back to another point we were discussing before, is that when I first came here, I spoke with a lot of my ex-air traffic control colleagues that were already living here in the States. And I told them, hey, what can I do to get back into aviation? What can I do? I want to do this again. I want to be air traffic controller. I want to do whatever. I want to be back in aviation. A lot of people just told me, it's very difficult. Just look at me. I just do a normal job. I do this. And very successful people on this side, of the world doing something else. But you could see that every time we had a meeting, we get together, and everybody would go back and start talking about aviation and air traffic control and telling stories and all that. And I keep thinking to myself, I want to go back. I want to do this. I don't want to just sidetrack into something else. Right. When I retire, I want to say I did this.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I want to say that when we first met you, you were at like a paper company or an e-paper company. Is
yes.
That right?
Yes. Yeah. So it was a photocopy software company. And I was a salesman there for them. And it was going great. I was doing very, very nice. And the thing that brought me to Wayman is that I had to drive every day from my house to work there in Miami Lakes. Mm-hmm. And I would drive by and look at the airplanes and see everybody, in the pattern and all that. And one day, they always had that aviation bug still, right? I saw a plane coming in and then a runway change because a cold front was moving in. Mm. I say, you know what? I want to do this again. Excellent. I don't want to sidetrack in something else. And as soon as I got back home that day, I think I sent you an email or something, or applied for a Discovery flight. And then our whole relationship started going there. So that was a highlight. Very nice.
And I remember that day. I remember getting the resume and being like, this is a former air traffic controller, like, selling paper. Like, no, we got to get him in here, right? And that's the amazing thing, because, I'm a first generation here in the United States, as are you. I came much younger, though. But people that come to the U.S. from all around the world, you have to do what you have to do to survive when you get here, right? That's the first job. That's, the guy working at the gas station, the person, picking up a job at the mall. Like, I can't tell you how many doctors I've known that were working retail jobs, yes. Right? Because you don't have your licenses in the U.S., you can't practice, and you've got to feed yourself or maybe even your family, mm-hmm. right? But I love that you found the way, and it was probably just gnawing at you. Like, I got to get back into aviation, right? And the time you spent with us were excellent. You set up our ATC communications class, right? Mm-hmm. Our phraseology class.
Right.
For those of you that are watching that don't know, phraseology is kind of the language of aviation, right? It's the vocabulary, the terminology used in aviation. And having taught air traffic control, and I guess with now I know a little bit more about your background, with your Canadian upbringing, you really were a no accent, right?
Yes. A little bit. It's still have my accent.
it's a worldly accent now. It's a worldly accent.
So, yeah, and I remember you brought it back to old school because here's everyone talking about VR and virtual reality, and our neighbors, Pan Am on 36th Street, had this room with all these screens and computers. And you're like, no, no, we need string and model airplanes, right? And that was the best class. I bet you any one of our students from that time and place can remember Carlos's ATC class, where you would kind of hold an airplane and kind of give your communications, receive your communications. If you're curious, visit our YouTube channel, youtube.com/WaymanAviation, and type in air traffic control, or just scroll kind of towards the bottom, and you'll see that ATC video with Carlos explaining it. And it's such a simple system, but it really does put you in three dimensions, thinking about where is this airplane in relation to that airplane or in relation to the runway, right? Because people do have a hard time thinking in 3D.
Yes.
Right? And it had never occurred to me until you kind of presented this idea, like, let's teach it with strings and just airplanes hanging. Sure. That's how you learned air traffic control, is that right?
That's how we learned the basics. As a matter of fact, the FAA even does it here. That's one of the basic things you do.
Excellent.
And it looks old, it looks very basic, but there's nothing like it, because the exercise is always on pause until the student talks.
Okay.
So there's no pressure. It gives the student the time to think about, see where his plane is at, what he has to say. So for beginners, that's the best way. A 3D simulator is very nice. Everybody likes it, sure. But it's going. So you got to move at the pace that the exercise is happening. This is excellent for beginners.
I want to bring it back. When we went to, because we were keeping it pretty consistent, I think over here in our, in what is now our conference room, it used to be our main classroom at North Perry. But with the pandemic, we went to our phraseology class being online with this wonderful company who does an iPad-based kind of instruction. But there's nothing like sitting in that three-dimensional space and then inviting the traffic controllers in to meet the students, so you know who you're talking to. And then, of course, the tower tour, right? And we love our tower tours. I miss it dearly. But, of course, right now with COVID precautions, you can't visit any towers.
Right.
Very difficult to get a tower visit, so we haven't even bothered. But I'd love to bring that back sometime, right? So we had a wonderful time with you. We can probably kind of dig up a ton of stories, but you set up a lot of just processes, which we keep to this day at Wayman Aviation Academy. So I definitely credit you with our dispatch department. Now it's a whole department.
Yeah, I know. Beautiful, by the way.
It's a whole department with a nice office and like five or six people just kind of involved in the dispatch duties day to day. Because when we fly 7 days a week from sunrise until midnight, you have to have a dispatcher on duty. You know, we don't have somebody on duty at 3 a.m. like national, but I don't know, if it gets busier, we might have to. All right. So you're with us at Wayman. It's great to welcome you back into the world of aviation. But you're looking for some heavier metal, right? You really want to flex that muscle. So you turned to one of our local carriers, IBC, right? IBC, very storied company. Tell us about your time and your role at IBC.
Well, that was interesting as well, because there were IBC being a Part 135 carrier. As they were growing, it was at the beginning very, very, very basic. You know, plane lands, the pilot sends a text message or an email, we're here, we blocked in at this time. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of, again, some more involvement in creating a lot of processes. Mm-hmm. Some things are, you know, our students, Wayman students will see as they go on, you know, moving messages, IATA form and moving messages to inform the stations that you've been on the ground, that you're taking off, your ETA, so on and so forth. A lot of communication with the ground handlers and other air traffic control entities to keep the operation running smoothly, because as they grew to a 10 plus fleet aircraft, it became necessary. So then again, I was again in the same position that I was at Wayman, where we started creating all these processes and things, and the experience acquired at Wayman helped me a lot over there. So it got to a point where we had a whole department. We were hiring dispatchers from dispatch school because they saw the benefits of having actual dispatchers in there.
Mm-hmm. Now, so IBC, for those that don't know, I'm not sure what IBC stands for. Do you know what IBC stands for?
Oh, absolutely. It started from a trucking company up in New York.
Really?
And it still is a big freight forwarder company. If you look at IBC Inc., it's called International Bonded Couriers. So that means they take your cargo and they move it from station to station without the need to do customs at the first place. Which is what the term bonded means, building customs at the destination.
All right.
So it grew from that, and then a separate airline division, it grew out of it, which is IBC Airways.
Well, it's still very appropriate because they're international bonded couriers. They're still taking it to its destination. That makes sense.
Correct.
So IBC is a really interesting operation, and they fly a range of airplanes, mostly around the Caribbean, right? And they're based here out of South Florida. It's a great option for especially young pilots. You know, the tried and true path that we know to get students to their 1,500 hours, their ATP, is as flight instructors. But it's not for everybody, right? It takes a certain level of patience to be a flight instructor. And some pilots don't have it, right? But they're excellent pilots, wonderful pilots. So we've had dozens of pilots go to IBC. I remember Maxine and Michael and many. What's the fleet like, or what was the fleet like at IBC when you were there?
Well, we actually, we still hold a good relationship. I was just down there when I visited Wayman last week. They have 10 aircraft right now, 10 okay. Sub 340s and growing, Sub 340 freighters. They operate a small fleet of two Embraer 145 passenger,
nice.
Which they use for passenger flights down to Guantanamo, Cap Haitian in Haiti, and they also do sports teams up in the United States. So they do a lot of flying up north with the passenger jets.
They're also, if I recall, pretty active whenever the disasters happen in the Caribbean. Like right now, they're probably supporting Haiti.
Yes.
So that's great because that's what those flexible 135 carriers are good at. Like something happens and they can redirect versus scheduled services where, it's quite a disruption when something like that happens.
Right.
But it's a great opportunity for pilots to build up time here flying around the Caribbean. I'm going to take you up on that. I really want to get in contact with IBC and see if we can make a Wayman IBC official connection there.
Absolutely. And the wonderful part about IBC is that it works for everybody. If you're a young pilot and you want to stay in South Florida, beautiful, it's right there. You get a chance to fly jets. They have a nice career path with other big airlines like Amerijet, who fly 767. I think you mentioned Maxine. Maxine is flying 767 around
for
Amerijet. So their operation is very unique. They operate Monday through Friday. You take off in the morning and you're back home at 6 p.m. So it's kind of like a banker's hour airline. To me, is the only one I've seen. There's occasional charter flights in the weekend, but it's, with the amount of pilots that they have, you might have to fly a weekend in a month or maybe none at all.
That's nice. And that's a good point.
Go ahead.
I'm thinking the vast majority of your freight is flown at night, right? Yes. You always hear about the FedEx and DHL pilots like flying in the middle of the night. They don't, it's all nighttime. They don't get any daytime flights.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So they pick up all the freight coming in from DHL, UPS, and FedEx, and they move that to the Caribbean. And they do the same thing in the afternoon. They bring it back to the hub in Miami, and then from there, all the big carriers take it over.
That's a great place to be. And you're right. That's like an unheard of pilot schedule. That rarely happens, especially early on in your career, right? But you also have the opposite. You also have a lot of senior pilots that are tired of having those, 4 or 5 day trips. They want to be home in the evening for their kids, for their family, right? And that's another place where a carrier like IBC is excellent, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think of the airlines that are out here like Amerijet, IBC, Silver Airways as well, flying Saabs and now ATRs. It's one of those jobs where you can sleep in your own bed at night, right?
Yes.
And be the captain. So there's an excellent place for those. So IBC went through a lot of growth, and I imagine like National over the last year and a half of the pandemic, cargo has been going nuts. It's been going crazy, right? Have you seen a lot of that growth? Is it impacting National?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, 70% of the world's cargo was moved on the bellies of passenger airplanes, and that disappeared completely at some point. Mm-hmm. And it's coming back, but it's still not at the point where it was pre-pandemic-wise. So the growth at IBC, but at National has been exponential. The fleet's growing incredibly. We more than doubled the 747 fleet in less than 6 months. They acquired a A330 on the passenger side, 757 on the passenger side as well. They plan to bring more A330 freighters and passengers because you think of passengers aren't moving that much, but this is charter operation. So all the passengers that can't go on normal commercial airlines, scheduled airlines, now have to go with you, and there's still a lot of traveling to do. Especially for government officials, the military, sports teams, and all that thing. So it has been a good. It's the bad pandemic has been bad for everybody, but has some positive impact on the cargo carriers, which can now flourish and grow a little bit.
Total side story here, but I recently found out the Olympics just finished, and there was an airplane, I don't know who flies it, maybe it's Alice, but there's a special airplane that flies horses and had to fly all the horses from the U.S. to Tokyo. Do you know the name of what they called the airplane when it was flying?
No.
It was called Air Horse One. And I thought that was the greatest thing I'd ever heard. Air Horse One.
I did not know that.
All these Olympic horses across the Pacific. I thought it was
that great. Is awesome.
Yeah. But you know, that's actually quite a common thing. There's freighters that are built to carry livestock, horses. I've heard quite a bit, especially like in the Middle East, where there's like these large stables of horses, like they fly them around quite a bit, right?
Right. We've done flights of elephants, rescue elephants on a 747. That's an amazing sight.
That's got to be some crazy weight and balance.
It is, with all the logistical challenge it brings. Of course, those animals are going to be on board for quite a long period of time, usually up to 10 hours. So make sure they have food, they have a place to do their necessities, their normal physiological necessities. And all that you have to make sure is taken care of. The temperature has to be kept inside the aircraft at a comfortable level for them. So yeah, it's interesting, you know.
Yeah, that's interesting. There's a lot more considerations there. Yeah, because, you know, boxes in the belly, you don't really think too much about, right? It's just wait and go.
Right.
Yeah, there's a lot more to consider there. So let's take a step at a time. At IBC, what do you think was the most interesting cargo maybe that flew around when under your watch?
IBC, I believe one time we can't remember the origin. It was someplace in the islands in the Caribbean, in the smaller Antilles. I was talking to a pilot on the radio as he was coming in with the ETA information, and I could hear the dogs barking. Dogs. So we had they had like 200 dogs that they were bringing back, rescued from the hurricane. They were just stray dogs, and they brought it here to the States, and they were reunited with their family afterwards. So it was really nice. So I'm talking to the pilot regarding the dogs, and he said, "Yeah, don't worry, the dogs are not a problem. We have like 20 snakes back there."
That's not a problem. Snakes on a plane. Oh my gosh, so many jokes there. All right. And then, so coming forward to National, now it's much bigger, right? You're flying 747s around, so you're carrying elephants and other, I'm sure, very interesting things. Probably not at liberty to say, you know, all the crazy things that have flown around the world. But I found it really interesting, this Sam Chewy video, right? So humanitarian aid, I'm sure, has been a big thing, right? Getting PPE out around the world. There was evacuation flights. People were contacting me, like, how can I get an airplane to evacuate people from Peru to Hong Kong? I was like, I have no idea. Let me introduce you to my friend Carlos. I don't know. But I imagine there was a lot of humanitarian flights, a lot of evacuation flights.
Yes, yes. Right? A lot of flights with medical aid, supplies, both out of the United States and into the United States. Some goods we didn't have here, we didn't produce it as much as we needed it at that point. So we were importing all that. Some of the stuff we did produce here in the States, and then we were helping other countries with it. So it was a lot of back and forth, incredible logistics around the world to make this happen. From everybody, all the airlines, all the governments.
Yeah. You know, you talk about a job where you learn something every day. I bet like in the span of a couple of weeks, you became like an expert in like medical supplies and logistics of where this is manufactured and how to get it there and here. Yeah, it's kind of like you look online right now and everybody's a vaccine expert or everyone's a this expert or everyone's a that expert. Every week it changes. But in the dispatch world, you really have to. You got to like know your stuff and learn it very quickly.
Yeah. Pharmaceuticals are a big part of it. We used to fly a lot of pharmaceuticals from the States and into the States. And you have to learn at which temperature it had to be kept, the cargo compartment in the main and the lower. Dispatcher has to inform this to the pilot with the load masters as well and make sure it happens. Sometimes you have to stop for fuel. You know, we're going to really, really far away places in the world with heavy cargo. So we have to stop for fuel. And you got to make sure those conditions are kept at that fuel stop, at that tech stop.
I understand that Miami International actually recently got a special designation as a pharmaceutical hub. Like, I guess it's got special air-conditioned areas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it not only is it can you carry it, but where can you carry it too? Because you have to be able to receive it with the right equipment to handle that stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
So if you have an airport closure, if you're flying to somewhere and weather goes below mint and you have to go to the alternate, you have to make sure your alternate has facilities to hold that pharmaceuticals. Sometimes we don't have enough crew duty time available to bring the plane out of the alternate back to the original destination, and you have to put the crew on rest. But you got to make sure your alternate airport meets those requirements. So that's on top of, you know, runway classification numbers, ARF index for firefighting capability, all those things. So you have to stay on top of them. There's multiple variables.
You're thinking like, yeah, so you're playing like three-dimensional chess here. You're in a whole other world. And you know, that's funny because that's actually a hiring question we put to our dispatchers. When we're hiring dispatchers, I ask, are you a chess player? And, you know, some people say yes, some people say no. And I think I always say it's because you've got to be thinking 2-3 steps ahead, right? Is the airplane available? Will it be available for the next flight? How about fuel? How about weather? You're you have to be someone that can think ahead, right?
Yes.
And that's not everybody. Some people can really just handle what's in front of them. And dispatchers are certainly thinking ahead. Now, you mentioned an interesting role there that we haven't talked about, loadmaster, right? That's kind of like a subsection of dispatch, right? Just focus on weight and balance. Kind of explain to me that role.
Well, the loadmaster is not inside the SOC of dispatch per se. Okay. Depending on the airline and how it operates, the loadmaster actually flies with the aircraft. He's a crew member. He's there with the airplane. So given the nature of what National does, we don't have a loadmaster station at every airport. On the contrary, he or she is with the airplane at all times. So he's part of the crew. But while the plane is flying, he's working on the weight and balance and distributing the cargo on the airplane with fuel and everything else for the next cargo they're going to pick up. So when they land, they know exactly which position to put each pallet, depending on the contour. That information has to be given to the handler so they can build up the pallet in that regard. A contour for a freight building, you know, putting together boxes on top of the pallet, it's not the same for a 747 than for an MD-11 or a 747-400 or a 747-8 because of the difference. And when you go to the lower, the forward part of the main deck on the 74, the ceiling is a little bit lower because of the upper deck. So you got to make sure that the pallet you have to put there meets the requirement. So there's a lot of work involved, and it's also a very nice career path.
That's really interesting. So let's talk about that, right? So now you've kind of gotten to know how you got there and all these different roles. So somebody that's curious, somebody that's interested in getting into the world of aviation, being a pilot's not for them. Maybe it's medical reasons or maybe it's otherwise, right? How do you get your foot in the door? How do you even get started in the world of dispatching or flight operations?
Well, the first thing you got to do is find a school that you like. Do your research, go online. There are multiple schools in the United States that you can go to. Fortunately, one of the best ones we have up there in for a lot of those. So you can, the students can look it up in Plantation. Sheffield Aviation, they can apply, they can go if they want. Miami-Dade also provides
great things about
the ones that are down south in Miami. Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing you got to do. And of course, deciding what do you want to do? Do you want to be on the ground? Do you want to be inside the operations control room of an airline, or you want to be on the plane? Mm-hmm. I have a friend that he wants to be a loadmaster. He tells me, I want to be on the aircraft the whole time. And I tell him, why don't you fly the airplane then? No, I'll leave that to the pilot. I prefer to do something else. But yet he wants to be on the airplane.
Yeah.
So that's another nice way to do it.
So kind of going back to the beginning of our conversation, you said the duty manager is overseeing all these different roles, right?
Yes.
We know there's a pilot shortage. We know that there's a shortage of technicians, that mechanical technicians to work on the airplanes. Where do you think there's a shortage on the flight operations side? Is there a shortage?
Well, yeah, definitely. There's a shortage of dispatchers because we had the same issue because of COVID that the pilot had. Most airlines retire. Of course, dispatchers tend to stay. You know, once you get to a major airline, that is what you want to do. They tend to stay there for a while.
Sure.
So they retire. They got the opportunity to retire early. And contrary to what everybody thought, they say, okay, they're not going to hire a dispatcher for at least 3 or 5 years. Airlines started opening.
Right.
And now they're hiring for dispatchers everywhere. American Airlines, Spirit, everybody's hiring for dispatchers.
So everyone's
and there is not that availability of people prepared, ready to do so because everybody's stopped.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not going to go to school now because they're not going to hire me. People were thinking that way.
Sure.
And now everybody's rushing to get in there. The airlines are rushing to hire. So there is a shortage of dispatchers. There's a shortage of technicians inside the SOC or OCC. There are also mechanics that work as a maintenance control. during communication, if the pilot calls you, as a dispatcher, and tells you, hey, I have an issue here, I'm getting a high oil pressure temperature on engine or something like that, you have to patch him through into a conference call with maintenance control, and they will help him troubleshoot that live. And you're listening, and you know exactly what's going on, and you're part of the conversation and determining the best course of action. So that's also a very interesting role on the technician or maintenance side.
Interesting. Now, you mentioned that you definitely need the dispatcher exam, the equivalent of the ATP exam, to be a dispatcher. Are there any other requirements, or are there positions kind of in flight operations that you don't need that? Maybe someone can get their foot in the door while they're studying or learning to do that?
Absolutely. There's a variety of positions inside operations, inside the SOC, OCC, like crew scheduling. Crew scheduling, ground operations, what you do in ground operations side, what you do is you coordinate all the ground handling aspect of the flight. Make sure everything's taken care of before the plane gets there. Fuel, catering, bedding for the air, the airplane, bunk beds for the crew to rest, all sorts of things. Cleaning the lab, everything. So since we don't have a station at every airport, because we can't, everything is done from operations. So all that coordination is done by that person in there. So that's one of the busiest roles inside the SOC, at least for national airlines and other carriers that do the same. Crew scheduling. These positions do not require a certificate. And you can put your foot inside the company that way, and you get a lot of experience. Crew scheduling is also very, very technical. It's very important, because you have to deal a lot with crew rest legalities and how much duty they can do. And it's different from operation. It's different from the crew rest requirements and duty time for the 74 are not the same as for the passenger fleet. Really? So they're very different. And this person gets a lot of knowledge on crew operation. So before you go to dispatch, you know, if you have this background, this is great.
That's really interesting. That's a good point, because there's a lot of people don't know that there's so many laws and restrictions around duty time, how much pilots can work. Pilots don't really have overtime. It's actually very much limited to how many hours you can work. So you could land on the opposite side of the world, your duty time's up, you legally cannot fly that airplane to the next stop, right? So that means finding a hotel for the crew and getting the rest, or flying in a whole nother crew. So the expenses around this are astronomical, I'm sure, to be moving pilots around and even flying a 757 to position crews all around the world.
Yeah.
We actually have a question right now from Jose. Hello, Jose. Thank you for joining us. He's interested in logistics, and he's wondering what the requirements are, what the job requirements would be for a loadmaster.
Well, a loadmaster, I'm not very familiar what the job requirements are in terms of the company, what they ask for, in terms of experience, you know. Definitely it is not an FAA certificate that you have to obtain. So you get most of your training in-house. If you apply and you're picked, you will get most of your training in the airline that you apply and get hired at. It is very intense training, but it's done there locally.
That makes sense. You know, all these roles that we're talking about, it really, I think, paints a picture here, because we always have heard the number 1 in 4 jobs in Miami is tied to aviation. Miami International Airport is the largest employer in the county, right? And they're not all pilots, right? There's loadmasters, there's dispatchers, there's counter crew, maintenance technicians, ramp operations, everybody from the person that takes your bag at the front door to mechanics putting fuel, line fuelers, mechanics working on the airplanes, all the way to the dispatchers that are probably not even on site, right? Because you're oftentimes not physically at the airport. You're probably at an office nearby.
Right.
Right. I think that's that whole, the Blue Lagoon buildings, I think, near Miami International are all full of airline positions.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we're in Orlando. We're not even at the airport. We're a little bit north, about 2 miles. You can see the airport, but you're not physically in the airport property.
Yeah. Why pay that airport rent, right? You know, like, you can have a nice office a little bit offsite. That's really interesting. Now, for anybody interested in pursuing this, any advice, any tips on how to get started into that career of airport operations, airline operations?
Airline operations is all, aviation in general, is all about passion. If you like it, there's a lot of hard hours, a lot of sleepless nights, but it's definitely rewarding. It's one of the nicest thing you do when you have to, you know, you're working midnight, but you see a plane come in and there's an issue and you solve it and that plane departs in time and the passengers are happy. and you kept the operation going. It's completely rewarding. And like I said, if you like aviation, you're going to enjoy this. And putting your there are many ways to get into the airline world. You can start at the airport. You can even start as a gate agent and work your way up to where you want to be. I believe Southwest have this program where you start as an operation agent, and they'll facilitate everything for you. If you want to pursue a career as a dispatcher, you can go all the way, and they actually give you preference. Yeah. So that's a nice way to get in. If you don't have the money to spend on classes, mm-hmm. and you want to work your way up, that's also an option.
You know, I see that more and more. People, especially our young listeners and watchers, don't be afraid of an entry-level job, right? Everyone thinks they're going to jump right in, they're going to be the vice president, right? Like, don't be afraid to work the ramp, to be a gate agent, to do those starting jobs. Same thing with flight attendants. I can't tell you how many flight attendants have come to Wayman Aviation and gone from the cabin to the cockpit, making that transition, right? And the airlines love this because you understand the lifestyle, you understand the company, right? And so they would rather invest in their crew's education and have them move up those ladders and fill the positions with people that understand the company and have done those jobs, that have been out there on the front line, right? So don't be afraid about an entry-level job. Don't be afraid about visiting your local airport. If you don't know where to start, visit your local airport and pass out resumes like Carlos did here, right? There's mechanics shops, there's 135 charters everywhere, there's flight schools at every airport, right? And right now, everyone is in need of help, right? Everyone needs help and hiring because the airline industry has a shortage in just about every career field you can think of. Pilots, technicians, dispatchers, operations, they need crew, right? What is it? Spirit and American Airlines canceled hundreds of flights over the last few weeks, not so much because of a pilot shortage, but because of a ground crew shortage.
Right.
Yeah, they just didn't have people to actually get the airplanes ready to go. And I think it's very telling.
See what you want to do, where you want to be, and don't be, like you said, don't be afraid to take a step back. I did myself from IBC. I was an OCC manager. I was making processes and procedures and everything. And I went from being an OCC manager to being just a simple dispatcher at National Airlines with the pay cut that brings. But I knew I wanted to do that. I want to work for a 121 operation. I want to use my certificate as a dispatcher, and I want to get the experience. And the only way to do that is, you take a step back, move to the side, and then go from there. And really, with the background that I had, it took me about 6 months or to a year to move into the duty manager role. Wow, but if I had been afraid to take a step back, I never would have gotten this international 747, wide body experience that I have now.
And they're beautiful. I love the paint schemes on those national.
It is.
So how can people get a hold of you or learn more about National or IBC? Anywhere you would direct them to?
Oh, sure. You can reach me on my Facebook site. You can direct message me. No issues at all. I'm happy to do this. And I think you know me for a while. And I know how difficult it is sometimes to get into the aviation world, especially when you come here to the States. And I made it a purpose in my life to help everybody that could get into aviation. So, if you approach me and you say, hey, Carlos, I need your help with this. Can you let me know how to do it, your advice, how you did it? I'll be more than happy to help you.
Excellent. So that's at Carlos Rivera. If you want to get a hold of him on Facebook, look up National Airlines, and their YouTube channel has this excellent video with Sam Chui doing the humanitarian flight to Kathmandu. If you want to learn more about Wayman Aviation Academy, we are on all the social media channels at Wayman Aviation. That's on Instagram, on Facebook. Our YouTube channel is full of these videos. You'll be able to watch this video on YouTube and our podcast, which is available on Spotify, on Apple Podcasts, wherever it is you get your podcasts. Always make sure to like and subscribe it, because that's how we can keep doing more of these and getting excellent guests like Carlos here. I'm so proud of you and everything you've accomplished since you came here to the United States. And I love that you're kind of spreading that and helping as many more other people kind of reach their passions, their dreams in aviation. That's the mission, right?
Absolutely. It's my pleasure to help. I get satisfaction out of seeing somebody go in and pursue and, achieve their dreams. It's just wonderful.
It's incredibly rewarding. Thank you so much, Carlos. Thank you to our listeners for watching today. Blue skies and tailwinds for you. Thank you so much. Have a great evening.
Thanks for having me.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
This series is brought to you by Wayman Aviation Academy. learn to fly with a safe, reliable, professional academy located between Miami and Fort Lauderdale in sunny South Florida, USA. Enjoy the training and cosmopolitan life with Wayman's 42 aircraft, 6 airline partners, and 2 bases to help you be the captain.